Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Kerry Lavrov deal to disarm Syria's chemical arsenal by mid-2014 and speak with Joshua Landis, who writes a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics, Syria Comment. We will discuss how the Russian-American deal that Syria has not yet agreed to might be implemented and how the U.S. can maintain a credible threat to strike when the president may not be able to get congressional approval to do so, since the majority of Americans have no stomach for another war. Then we'll go to Beirut and speak with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is writing a book about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of Mubarak. We'll look into claims by the Syrian rebels that Assad is transferring his chemical arsenal to Iraq, Iran, and Hezbollah, and question why Americans who love the revolutionaries in Tahrir Square in Egypt seem unenthusiastic about supporting Syrians who oppose their dictatorship. Then we'll examine the humanitarian aspects of the continuing agony in Syria with Rebecca Hamilton, who teaches at Columbia Law School and was a lawyer with the International Criminal Court in Darfur, Sudan. We will discuss the forthcoming UN report on the use of chemical weapons in Syria and whether it will lead to a referral of the Assad regime to the International Criminal Court. Then finally, we'll discuss the new study by economists Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty that finds the rich got richer throughout the recovery from the 2008 Wall Street crash. David Ruscio, a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame, joins us to discuss the graphic evidence that we are in a new gilded age, as the top 10% took more than half of the country's total income in 2012, the highest level recorded since the government began collecting statistics a century ago. Joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the president of the Syrian Studies Association. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
Good to be with you.
And the Syrian government has not yet agreed to the Kerry-Lavrov deal that's giving them a week to hand over a list of all of their chemical weapons arsenal. However, Syria's Minister of Reconciliation, Ali Haidar, said, "We welcome the agreement. It is a victory for Syria achieved thanks to our Russian friends." So what's your sense of whether there'll be any kind of hiccup in the very early stages of this long process?
Well, I think there'll be hiccups all the way along. Syria has a lot of reasons not to want to hand over their chemical weapons. And chief among them is that this helps the regime to survive. Not only does it kill people and frighten its enemies, but it frightens the West and the neighbors of Syria, most of whom think that the only thing worse than Assad having chemical weapons is if the rebels capture them. And so that, in a sense, is good for his regime. It means that they don't want the rebels to win, or they're fearful if should the rebels win.
Well, of course, this deal does not stop the Russians from resupplying Syria and the U.S. from supplying the rebels.
No, it does not. And that's going to be, you know, many people are beginning to talk about trying to link this conversation about chemical weapons somehow to further political solution to the civil war down the road. And, you know, the State Department is trying to get up various proposals for Kerry on how one can get to a political solution. So that's the hope, at least, that once you get this dialogue between the United States and Russia on the one hand, and Assad brought along, that perhaps this could lead to more than just restricting the use of chemical weapons and destroying chemical weapons.
So, Joshua Landis, do we have a kind of disconnect here between the broader global arena where Russia and America appears to be working together? President Obama has said that if diplomacy fails, the United States must be prepared to act. There are some questions to whether he has lost his leverage or if he had the leverage since he went to the Congress to strike, because it's doubtful he'll get a vote. And the American people have no stomach for another war.
Of course, he can use unilateral. I mean, he is the president of the United States, and he can send off missiles. And many of the Republicans, in fact, who were lining up to vote against his strike, were telling the news agencies that he should have, he was a coward and he was fickle, and that he should have just gone ahead and used his presidential powers to strike Syria without a vote back in Congress.
Well, I was going to say, though, in the broader arena, there seems to be some positive stuff. On the ground in Syria, nothing's changed. It's just getting worse and worse. But on the outside global stage, the president has confirmed that he's exchanged letters about Syria with Iran's newly elected president, Hassan Rouhani. And he's also said that they actually have Obama said that Iran – the nuclear dispute with Iran is larger than the Syrian crisis, and that what they should do, speaking about the Iranians, just draw from this lesson, is that there is a potential for resolving these issues diplomatically. My view is that you have both a credible threat and a force combined with rigorous diplomatic if you have a credible threat of force combined with a rigorous diplomatic effort, you can strike a deal. So this Obama's already suggesting, as others have before, that the deal that Kerry and Lavrov did is a good blueprint for working with Iran on the bigger issue, as Obama has framed it.
Well, it is. But, of course, as is so well underlined, credible threat has to be generated, or else Assad's going to begin dragging his feet, and this whole thing could easily fall apart.
So what's your sense, then, of whether this is a sellout in terms of the opposition? They're obviously very unhappy with it. The general who speaks for the opposition has already said that Assad is moving his chemical weapons to Iraq, Iran, and Hezbollah. We'll be looking into that in a moment. But would you view this as the U.S. selling out the opposition?
You know, I don't. President Obama was very clear from the beginning that he was only interested in deterring chemical weapons. He was not trying to get involved in the Syrian civil war and change the balance of power. The original wording for the resolution was quite narrow. Now, McCain and others who do want to see the Sunni rebels win and to destroy the Assad regime began to try to expand that in Congress. And Obama did it. Kerry broadened the language of the resolution in order to win the votes of McCain and his followers. It wasn't going to be enough. But that did, in a sense, set the opposition, the Syrian opposition, to hoping that somehow that Obama would get involved deeply. The rest of the world might get involved behind him, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Europe. But the British vote really knocked the wheels out of those aspirations. But there was still great hope that Obama would strike and that this would set off then a cycle of strikes and so forth between Assad and the United States, which could help bring down the regime. And that, you know, because Obama backed away from that, there is great distress amongst the Syrian rebels, no doubt about it. Syrian regime supporters, thrilled. Their children, who are all in the military, it means that they're not going to be struck with American cruise missiles. And so, you know, there was a big sigh of relief from the regime supporters, and the regime opponents are very distressed.
So, but on the other hand, are the Free Syrian Army and the various militias, I think all told about 2,000 of them, are they relieved that they're not going to be struck by chemical weapons?
Well, that is the upside for them, is that as this process goes forward, Assad cannot use chemical weapons, even if he's going to delay, linger, and wait. And that's good for them because it means that chemical weapons, the United States is doing something about chemical weapons. There's a lot of pressure on Assad not to use them. And had nothing been done, it seems quite certain that Assad would go ahead and use these as a part of his tactical arsenal.
Well, obviously, what Assad continually says is that the rebels, it's either me or the terrorists, and the extent to which the Saudis and the Qataris have armed and allowed these jihadis in, I think, has played right into Assad's hands. He is obviously going to be around for quite a bit longer, depending upon how this, and it's worth noting that the civil war continues and both the United States and Russia will be arming both sides. The CIA apparently has just recently sent its teams in that is trained. It's taken them a couple of years to get them into the field. I don't know whether that's going to tip the balance. What's your sense of given that this deal, the Lavrov-Kerry deal, goes on till mid-2014, is that an acknowledgement that this war is going to go on?
Yes, it is. And, you know, the United States policy has been to give the opposition, the Syrian opposition, enough weapons so that it does not lose, but not enough so that it can win and destroy the Assad regime. And that's a recipe for stalemate, and it's a recipe for eventual division of Syria along the present battle lines. And Syria could well be divided into three different regions, a Kurdish region in the northeast, an Arab Sunni region around Aleppo and in the north, and then a region controlled by the Assad regime in the south and in the west coast, along where the Alawites are the majority along the ocean. And that's the present reality in Syria. And unless something happens to switch the balance of power, that's going to endure, it would seem, for a long time. It's already been the situation for well over a year and a half, and there hasn't been great movement one way or the other.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the president of the Syrian Studies Association. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. But my understanding is that the Sunni, and not to mention the Kurds, would not accept a partition of Syria unless they had access to the ocean. And if the Alawites control the coast, how's that deal going to work out?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's a stickler. The only way it would work out is if nobody could win. And, you know, this is why Assad, in a sense, is holding on to Damascus, even though Damascus is a majority, overwhelmingly majority Sunni city. He has tons of rebels and opposition within the poorer suburbs of the city. It's very hard to see how he keeps control of it in the long run. The thing is, he needs to hang on to it. Otherwise, Damascus is the center of money, wealth, the capital. Whoever owns Damascus is going to end up owning Syria. And a little Alawite rump state on the coast would be very weak economically, politically, and every other way. And if he were to retreat back to the coast, it's not at all likely that he would be able to hang on to power there. He would eventually get swept out. And that's the fear, of course, of the regime and of the Alawites, is that they would be pushed into the sea. And that's why they're fighting tooth and nail, and why they're unlikely to collapse anytime soon. But if there's a stalemate that endures, it can be, you know, this would just become the reality. And there's nothing that anybody could do about it. And that is where the U.S. policy and European policy is leading, if it continues to support the rebels just enough so that they don't lose, but not enough so that they can win.
So that's a pretty cynical policy. That appears to be the one we've had all along, right?
It is. Well, and we're also balancing Russia. I mean, Russia is working into this. Iran's working into this. And America has no stomach to really take Syria away from Russia. You know, if you really want to be cynical about it, in a sense, the United States, I think many people in the United States, rue the day that they took Afghanistan away from Russia in 1979, which led to the Taliban, led to 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. And in some ways, I think, you know, as Afghanistan was a poison chalice, many people look at Syria as a poison chalice. What do you do with it if you were to take it away from Russia? It's a country in splinters, and they're frightened of it. They're frightened of what can come next.
Well, Joshua Landis, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the president of the Syrian Studies Association. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back going to Beirut and talking about the possibility of the chemical arsenal being transferred to Iran, Iraq, and Hezbollah.
Nothing!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Beirut is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation, and he writes the International's column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his forthcoming book is about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you as always, Ian.
And you're right next door to Syria there, and the Syrian opposition, who I guess feel that they're being sold out by this Russian-American deal, have said that already Assad is shipping out his chemical weapons to Iraq, Iran, and to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Is there any truth to that?
Well, we obviously don't know any solid information about that, and I think if the U.S. could credibly pin that down, they would make a big public fuss about that because that violates the very heart of this agreement. Now, it's possible, of course, to sneak small quantities of this stuff around, and there's absolutely no reason to trust Bashar Assad here. I mean, that's the bottom line behind those rumors is that this guy has nobody's best interest at heart but his own, and he has zero compunction about violating international norms and killing civilians in any manner, including using chemical weapons. So he's still dangerous.
Well, but the Israelis would strike. And isn't that why they've struck already inside Syria? Because they believe that weapons are being transferred to Hezbollah? So if this were to happen, it would invite an Israeli strike, wouldn't it?
If it were to happen and be noticed or known. And I think the chemical weapons issue gets, in some ways, an unfair amount of attention because, as we've, I think, discussed before, even us on the show, conventional weapons have killed far more people in this conflict than chemical weapons. And whether, you know, it's the Israeli perspective where they're worried about Scuds far more than, say, a sarin gas attack over the Golan, or whether you're talking about the Syrian uprising, which, again, has suffered much more at the hands of conventional, just regular standard-issue mortar shells than at the hand of chemical weapons, that's the real sort of muscle of this regime. And in the past, when Israel struck inside Syria during this conflict, it was because the regime was believed to be transferring long-range or mid-range rockets, conventional rockets now, the Scuds or the like, to Hezbollah. And that sort of munition doesn't in any way fall under the purview of this agreement. And that sort of munition is in some ways quite easy to move under the radar. I mean, I think we assume for all the times that the American intelligence or the Israeli military made a public fuss or a strike over some purported weapons transfer, we assume that there's 10 times that the regime and Hezbollah have made such transfers successfully or attempted them without and gotten away with it.
So what is the reaction in Lebanon to this deal? The concern was that an American strike would inflame the region and possibly spread this from a war inside Syria to a more regional war. And already you've had some spillover into Lebanon with some bombing of Hezbollah and then a retaliation against a Sunni cleric in Tripoli. So what's the mood there?
Well, the mood in one word is anxious. And to elaborate, as usual, America doesn't get any credit for anything, whether it's refraining from irresponsible use of force or using it. So there's two general lines of reaction. One is from people who support the Syrian opposition, people who essentially wanted an American strike, and more than that, they want a real definitive conflict-altering intervention by the United States. These are people who would love to see ground troops come in or advisors or sustained airstrikes, a no-fly zone, all those sorts of interventions. So those folks are angry and disappointed, and they say, look at this, even in the face of an almost genocidal, sort of horrendous transgression of all our Western values, here the United States essentially slithering out of its moral responsibilities with a deal that, you know, politically saves face, but in real terms leaves the Syrian people hostage to the vicious machinations of Bashar al-Assad. On the other side, the folks who are either pro-regime or simply who want to see America keep out of it, they don't give any credit to the United States for doing this in an effective or diplomatic way. They say, ha, see, once again, America shows weakness and indecision, and even though in this instance we've escaped their ham-handed clumsiness, we are in no way reassured because the manner in which it happened leaves us convinced that America has no policy in the region and no strategic vision, and is sort of bumbling through. So we have a little bit less anxiety than we had about a week ago, but we have to we have to live with the fact that America basically gets criticized and either blamed for being responsible for everything wrong or blamed for being too weak to solve any problems. And either way, it's a lot of naysaying.
Again, I'm speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis in Beirut. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation, and he writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe. And his latest book is A Privilege to Die: Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his forthcoming book is about the Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. Now, you've been spending a lot of time in Cairo and in Egypt, and of course, it's somewhat been forgotten because of Syria's been in the headlines, but clearly the revolution in Egypt has taken a turn for the worst. For all intents and purposes, Mubarak is being rehabilitated. This clearly pleases the Saudis and the Israelis. I imagine the Egyptian opposition is very demoralized. I spoke to one of the leaders of the original revolution some time back when they were going after the Muslim Brotherhood, and he said, you wait, they'll come after the liberals once they've nailed the Brotherhood, and that seems to be exactly what's happening.
Yeah, it's an incredibly depressing turn of events in Egypt, and to try and look at some of the regional parallels here, I think there's some really striking ones. Number one, we see the real persistence of the old state system. We see this in Bashar al-Assad's resurgence, surviving so much of the uprising and then turning around and pulling off this chemical weapons deal that looks in some ways like it might keep him in power, if not forever, for a lot longer. And that, I think, clearly parallels what happened in Egypt, where after 2.5 years of revolutionary ferment and hope and, you know, Islamists in politics, liberals in politics, what we've seen primarily in the last month is the old system rearing its head and showing that it is almost entirely intact. And as you said, when they started going after the liberals, it was no surprise because the way that they deposed Morsi and immediately moved to outlaw the Muslim Brotherhood and kill and arrest its supporters was very much the style, not just of the Mubarak regime, but even of the Nasser, the early years of Nasser in the 1950s, when he had a similarly violent and pervasive crackdown. So we've seen that sort of the worst of the old Arab state system coming up. We've also seen an American fatigue with transformation and change, and this is another sad parallel. In Egypt, the U.S. government has seemed content not to call this coup a coup so that it can keep on giving aid, and to essentially bet on, make that same old horrible bet on stability over representational government and fair government. And I see, honestly and sadly, a parallel in the way the U.S. is talking about Syria. Because you look beyond the short-term question of the uprising, the chemical weapons attack, what we're seeing is a policy that essentially accepts the prospect of either Bashar al-Assad or a successor in his mold staying indefinitely in power in Syria, because America would rather have that than the democratic alternative, which would include a lot of jihadists and characters that the U.S. either can't manage or can't stomach.
Well, but how do you explain the fickle nature of the support that the United States and particularly progressives in this country had for those kids in Tahrir Square? There was exuberance both here and in Tahrir Square during that revolution and after. And there is no such enthusiasm for the revolution in Syria, which is in many ways similar. I mean, the people rose up spontaneously. Eventually, the Islamists infiltrated, if you will, the revolution. And in the case of Egypt, we love the revolutionaries. In the case of Syria, we don't love them.
I mean, we love the revolutionaries in Egypt because it was free. It didn't cost us anything to do that. Their rhetoric, at least in the simple way that the public in the U.S. understood it, their rhetoric sounded a lot like American liberal democratic dialectic, even though it was actually a lot more complicated than that. And ultimately, our government, the U.S. government, didn't do any of the things that it could have done to support that revolution. I mean, they didn't put any pressure on the Egyptian military, any meaningful pressure to move away from power in the 2.5 years of the transition. It put no pressure on the Muslim Brotherhood once it was elected to behave in an inclusive and legal and open-minded way, and in the aftermath of this latest coup, it's done nothing again to Syria's to pressure either the civilian government that nominally is in power or the army behind it to curb the abuses. And that that's a real strong contradiction, because I think what you're talking about is something very real, which is the American and Western public's real deep affection for the Egyptian uprising. And you ask, why did they like that and they didn't like Syria? And the real answer, in my view, is a very depressing one. It's not because of anything about the uprising, but it's because of the way that the regime responded. Tahrir looked great because the Mubarak regime was willing to step aside without killing tens of thousands of people. So it looked like a peaceful uprising, which is how it began. The revolution in Syria began the same way, but Bashar al-Assad was willing to kill any and everyone to stop it. So eventually, of course, the uprising resorted to force. And because not of the uprising itself, but because of the regime, we came to view it in a different way.
Well, just in terms, though, of the irony of both Saudi Arabia funding and supporting the return of the military regime in Egypt, and Israel also behind the scenes welcoming it and perhaps helping it restore itself to power. The Israelis, of course, are much more comfortable with Assad than they are with his opposition, but it's the Saudis in the case of Syria that have played right into Assad's hands, because Assad's basic position is, it's me or the terrorists, and it's the Saudis who are bringing the terrorists in.
Yeah, I mean, this is best understood as the regional Cold War between Saudi and its allies, the United States and Israel, against Iran and its loose alliance with Russia. And that's really what's going on in Syria as well. And you know, for all the notion that Israel would prefer a stalemate in Syria, or Israel would prefer Assad, Israel has quite actively done some things to support the opposition, and there's quite a lot of reports even of medical aid and some military aid going from Israel to even to jihadists who are fighting the regime. And I've heard from pretty reliable sources here that jihadists in Syria actually don't consider Israel a key enemy. They consider the regime a key enemy, and they're willing to work with Israel in the short term to unseat it. And that is kind of mind-blowing, but it speaks to the real depth of this regional struggle between Iran and the Shia orbit on one side and Saudi and the Sunni orbit on the other.
It certainly brings into question Vladimir Putin's bizarre charge in his op-ed in the New York Times that the jihadis in Syria were planning to strike Israel with chemical weapons. Thanks for joining us here from Beirut, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis in Beirut. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation, and he writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die: Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his forthcoming book is about the Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. And joining us now is Rebecca Hamilton, who is an author and journalist who teaches at Columbia University Law School and was a legal correspondent for Reuters. She covered the civil war in Sudan and was a special correspondent on Sudan for The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her latest book is Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Hamilton.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And Rebecca, you were a lawyer with the International Criminal Court and of course, the leader of now Northern Sudan, or Sudan, has been referred to the International Criminal Court. What are the chances following the UN report on the use of chemical weapons in the Damascus suburbs on August the 21st, assuming that the attack is attributed to the Assad regime, will this lead to a referral of the Assad regime to the International Criminal Court?
Look, one can't say with certainty before the debates at the Security Council tomorrow, but certainly I think it's more likely than it was even, say, 2 weeks ago. I think the conversation is starting to shift and you're hearing more discussion of the possibility of getting the ICC involved. But for the International Criminal Court to become involved in Syria, it has to come through the UN Security Council. Syria has not joined the court. So the court doesn't have the authority to go and investigate what's happening in Syria without the UN Security Council asking it to go in there.
And that would be subject then to the Security Council would be subject to a Russian or Chinese and or both veto, right?
Exactly. And the stumbling block until now has been the Russians. The UK proposed this a while ago. The Russians gave a very clear sign that they would veto any such proposal. But we're seeing these pieces shift. Since we've had the proposal come about the disarmament of the chemical weapons, you're seeing, I think, a bit more creativity on the diplomatic front and a little more openness towards exploring alternative options to the U.S. military strike. So I think, you know, there's no certainty that we'll see a referral to the ICC, but I think it is, again, more realistically back on the table.
Well, of course, the British have been, from the beginning, since this chemical attack, they have been trying to get a resolution based on R2P, the responsibility to protect. Where does that stand? Is that what you're referring to?
In their original draft resolution, they were talking about R2P, but as an additional component, a referral to the ICC, because there's sort of three prongs that are working in parallel. There's the diplomatic or political, there's the legal prong, and then there's the possibility of military action. And so, you know, I think if we get to the point where we do have a referral to the ICC, I think what is crucial is to realize that is, in and of itself, not going to change the dynamic in Syria. It's just one piece of this much more complicated puzzle, and we need all of those three pieces, the political, the military, and the legal, to be working in concert, which is something that we haven't had up until now.
So would the precedent be for the fact that you just said it wouldn't be necessarily change things in Syria? The precedent would be what happened with Sudan, where General Omar Bashir has been indicted, I guess, by the International Criminal Court and is still in power.
Right. And this is a very difficult thing for the ICC. It has no police force of its own. And so it relies on states to actually enforce its arrest warrants. Now, I think there's a particular obligation on the UN Security Council when it says to the ICC, you take this on. We think this is an important issue. We want you to be responsible for accountability here, to follow through that referral by supporting the ICC and actually executing its arrest warrants. And that's the kind of political support from the UN Security Council that we have never seen in Sudan. And I think if there is a referral to the ICC on Syria, it's crucial that the Security Council backs it up with political support to actually execute the warrants that the ICC would issue. And the other thing that the UN Security Council has been doing, it did it both for the Sudan case before the ICC and also the Libya case before the ICC. It asked the court to take on accountability, but didn't give it any funding to do so. The court is funded by the states that have joined the court, but I think there's a good argument to be made that when the Security Council is effectively outsourcing to the court, then it also needs to provide some funding to enable the court to do its job really well.
But it's worth noting, Rebecca Hamilton, that the United States has not signed on to the ICC. The Clinton administration at the executive level did, but it's never been ratified by the Senate.
That's right. And traditionally we international lawyers have sort of struggled with the fact that the US has, when it came to Rwanda, when it came to the former Yugoslavia, being a supporter of international criminal law, and then when it came to the ICC, backed out at the last minute. But that was under the end of the Clinton administration, certainly the first term of the Bush administration. But from the second term of the Bush administration, and even more so under the Obama administration, you've seen a softening of the US position towards the ICC. They didn't veto the referral of the ICC on Sudan, and similarly with Libya. So I think you're seeing, I wouldn't say that they're ready, that the US is ready to join the court, but certainly it's much more open to the court's existence. And I think, if Russia was not going to veto it, certainly the US would not be vetoing a referral on Syria to the ICC.
And again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Hamilton, who is an author and journalist who teaches at Columbia University Law School and was a legal correspondent for Reuters. She covered the civil war in Sudan, where she was a special correspondent on Sudan for The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her latest book is Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. But I find it a little hard, though, to see, Rebecca, the Russians not vetoing, given what Putin wrote in his op-ed piece in the New York Times, that he insists that Syria was not behind, or the Assad regime was not behind, the chemical weapons attack on August 21st. And indeed, he went on to say that the jihadis, who he holds responsible, did it as an act of provocation to bring the Americans strike in, and that the jihadis were going to use chemical weapons against Israel.
Well, one thing to understand about the ICC is that when it gets jurisdiction over a situation, it gets jurisdiction over the entirety of the situation. It never gets jurisdiction just to prosecute one side. So in terms of alleviating Russian concerns, the argument would be, and whether they're persuaded by this or not is a separate matter, but the argument would be this is an independent international court that can look at war crimes committed by all sides. And while certainly it would seem that the vast majority of crimes have been committed by the Assad regime, we also know that there have been war crimes committed by the rebel side. And the ICC is not going to be partisan. It will be looking at war crimes committed by all sides if it gets jurisdiction over the situation.
So just turning, Rebecca Hamilton, to the broader humanitarian crisis in Syria, how would you, since you spent so much time in Darfur and in Sudan and in South Sudan, and I think we spoke when at the time of the when South Sudan got its independence. So my question would be, how does this humanitarian catastrophe in Syria compare to others, given I think up to 6 million have either left the country or are internally displaced out of a population of, what, 20 million?
Yeah, so, I mean, firstly, I should say I haven't been in Syria at all during the crisis. But in terms of speaking with humanitarians that are operating out of Jordan and of Turkey, I think that what you're seeing is this mass displacement of people such that even when we can't get great access to what is happening inside Syria, we see as people flow over the borders the sorts of situations that they're facing. And right now, we have the world's attention focused on Syria, which makes it easier on the humanitarian side to secure funding for donor operations. Doesn't make the security situation any easier for them to operate in. But at least there's funding coming through. The risk is that this conflict continues to go on. It's been going two and a half years longer now. Darfur, for example, went on as going for a decade, and at some point the international community starts to lose interest, at which point funding for humanitarian operations drops off and concerns about the security of the humanitarian operation delivery service also drops down. So that's a concern as we as resolution takes longer and longer, is that issue is always in play. But I think any of these situations where you have mass atrocities, it is always the civilians that are bearing the brunt of it. And the other sort of dynamic that we see that is similar in terms of when it takes so long for the international community to find a workable solution or to help the parties find a workable solution, is that you have a fracturing of the opposition, you know, what it is now compared to what it was 2.5 years ago. And that is also very bad to civilians.
Well, indeed, it's the part of the opposition, the al-Nusra Front in Syria, that issued a fatwa against the Syrian Kurds, which prompted a massive migration, spontaneous migration of Syrian Kurds into Iraqi Kurdistan. And I did speak recently with an American journalist, Max Blumenthal, who was in the camps, the refugee camps in Jordan. And he said that the Jordanian military are controlling these camps and really don't want any more people in there. They certainly don't want to integrate them into Jordanian society. So they're bottling them up in the middle of nowhere without any water or sewerage. And just across the border, there are thousands and thousands of Syrian refugees trying to escape from Assad who can't get in. So
right. And yes, I mean, it's always the fact that the neighboring countries, the regional, when you have a regime that is so destructive, the consequences can never stay inside the country. They have to flow outside, and then so it's destabilizing for everyone in the entire region.
But is that a reason for the world to get more involved? Because much of what we've heard, I've heard over the last couple of years, is basically, you know, a plague on both their houses, and the U.S. doesn't want to take sides, and, you know, the American people are against any intervention, and the president, in spite of his threat to use force, may not be able to carry out that threat.
Well, I think the American people are it would seem at the moment against any military intervention, but that's a very different thing between to saying we're just not going to get involved at all. In other words, there's a long way between doing nothing and dropping bombs, as it were. And it's this track of political, diplomatic, and legal that I think the focus really needs to be on. And you know, often helpful if it is backed up by a credible military threat, but that should be a matter of last resort. And I certainly think it's unclear to me how the use of military force would actually assist the Syrian civilian population at this point. But if you can get to a resolution that works on the diplomatic and legal front, that seems to be the best chance for the civilian population.
Well, Rebecca Hamilton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Hamilton, who's an author and journalist who teaches at Columbia University Law School and was a legal correspondent for Reuters. She covered the civil war in Sudan, where she was a special correspondent on Sudan for The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her latest book is Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the new Gilded Age.
Tax collectors getting closer. still we have fun. There's nothing surer. The rich get rich and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Ruscio, who is a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, Rethinking Planning, Development, Globalization Essays in Marxian Class Analysis, and his forthcoming book is Mind the Gap. His occasional links and commentary are available at anticap.wordpress.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Ruscio.
It's good to be back with you, Ian.
So this study that Emmanuel Seiss and Thomas Piketty came out with just last week, it certainly seems to have gotten some notice. I noticed that Joseph Stiglitz, speaking at the AFL-CIO convention in Los Angeles last week, talked in terms of this study and went on to say that the hardworking and rule-abiding have seen their paycheck shrink or stay the same while the rule-breakers raked in huge profits and wealth. It made our economy sick and our politics sick too. So you've done some very graphic examples showing how showing the data and the effect of this data. When are the American people going to wake up and take to the streets?
Well, as you know, they already have. It is appropriate that today we're talking about the problem of inequality, what I think we should only characterize as obscene levels of inequality. On the fifth anniversary of the meltdown of the investment bank Lehman Brothers, after which the world economy, not only the U.S. economy, but the world economy was brought to its knees, and we're coming up on the second anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, right? The movement in the United States that, if it did nothing else, put the issue of inequality on the U.S. political map. When the Zuccotti Park protesters said that we are the 99%, that's exactly what they were pointing to. They were pointing to the issue of inequality, economic inequality, social inequality, and political inequality.
But this latest economic data, which indicates that we are worse off now in this new Gilded Age than we ever have been before since in the last century, since statistics were kept, we're the top 10% of the United States owns half of the total income of the United States. So we're not just an economy of the 1%. We know that since the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling, we've also become a government of the 1%.
Right. The Piketty and Sayers study, which is actually an updated version of a study that they've been carrying out for a number of years now, and they deserve a lot of credit for it. It's very, very good work. Indicates to us that, in some sense, we're back to where we started, which was a bad situation. So the situation today, or as actually in terms of the data that we have, 2012, is in broad strokes comparable to where things were in 2007, just before the crash, which itself was comparable to where things were in 1929, just before the crash that set off the first Great Depression. So those are the links that we want to make. And one of the wonderful things about Piketty and Sayers is the data that they are using, in fact, cover a long period of time, back to 1917. And so we can now make these comparisons based on the work that they've done. Back in 1929, the top 1% of the population brought in, I hesitate to use the word earn, but brought in or raked in 20% of the total income in the United States. That precipitated the crash that led to the first Great Depression. During the first Great Depression, And during World War II, that percentage fell and continued to fall in the immediate post-war period to a low of about 8%. And then in the mid-1970s, it turned around again and began to rise such that by 2007, they were back up to 20%.
And but David,
a little bit.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, just to finish up that thought, it declined a little bit in 2009 because of the crash of the stock market. And then what is perhaps most disturbing about their numbers, as if what I said before wasn't disturbing enough, is that we're back to the same trend that we were in prior to 2007. Inequality is rising again, such that if you just look at the what others are calling the recovery, the period from 2009 to 2012, top 1% incomes grew by over 30%. The bottom 90%, 99% incomes barely grew, to be exact, 0.4%. 0.4 to 32, that's why we're back on this trend of growing inequality.
But it would seem to me that that the economic realities are caused by the political capture by the 1%. Because if it's the as has happened, the hardworking middle class and working Americans, they were the ones, the taxpayers were the ones that bailed out Wall Street, made them whole, and now they're better off than ever, and the income divide is increasing and accelerating, as you've just pointed out. There are political reasons why we tax gamblers in the stock exchange at lower rates than working Americans do, as their paycheck is cut, and you know the payroll tax cut was taken out as a deficit reducing method. So the average worker is getting less now, while Wall Street makes more.
Right. So they're being squeezed on both sides. They're being squeezed by stagnant incomes, and they're being squeezed because the tax burden is increasingly being transferred from those who can but prefer not to pay to those who really can't pay anymore. I tend to think about it as a combination of economic capture and political capture. The fact that our economy is organized in such a way that a very, very tiny group at the top gets to walk away with the lion's share of what is produced gives them a certain amount of power that they can then use in the political sphere, which in turn supports their economic capture. So it's a combination of economic capture and political capture. And that's what we need to be worrying about here in this, what some are calling the new Gilded Age, others are calling the winner-take-all economy.
And again, I'm speaking with David Ruscio, who's a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. His books include Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, Rethinking Planning, Development, Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis, and his forthcoming book is Mind the Gap. His occasional links and commentary available at anticap.wordpress.com. So in terms of the apologists for this growing income inequality in the United States, it comes down to this notion that winners and losers are inevitable and that inequality is a necessary product of a capitalist economy. What's your response to that?
Well, that's the latest. So as I see it, having read the literature and watched the media over the course of the last 5 years or so, there were kind of two moments. In the first moment was a denial that inequality existed at all. And then, of course, given what we know, there was no way of maintaining that position. So having acknowledged that inequality exists, the second argument, the one I see being trotted out these days, is that inequalities are inevitable, and that they are justified, that that's how capitalism needs to work. And really, it's not all that bad, since those at the bottom are just fine. I find both of those arguments ludicrous. First, since I'm an economist and I deal in these facts, the facts just couldn't sustain the first silly argument, that inequality didn't exist. Now we have to deal with the second argument that's being proffered, which is that while inequalities exist, they're inevitable and they're okay. It's a kind of just desserts argument. It's hard to maintain that. There is no particular reason. The one that often gets used amongst mainstream economists is that people on the top have more education, more skills, and they basically deserve what they're getting. You cited Joe Stiglitz, who was one of the mainstream economists who has found that argument basically silly. And if you look then, not at the top 10%, because they all have college educations, but at the top 1% versus everybody else in the top 10%, or even higher, the top 0.1%, or if you want to look even smaller, the top 0.01%, they all have the same level of education. They all have the same skills, and yet those at the very top are the ones who are walking off with the lion's share. So the argument that they deserve what they are getting is impossible to sustain. We have a problem. And those who either deny that inequality exists or who attempt to justify inequality just don't want us to face up to the problem and the kinds of solutions we need to adopt in order to eliminate, as to say, what are these obscene levels of inequality.
But my understanding is that the problem is the growing financialization of the economy, that we have increasingly a capitalist system that's about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. At least the robber barons created wealth. And you can look at the price of gasoline at the moment. It went up because of a fear of a strike against Syria that's gone away. But the price of gas I just filled up today, it's gone way up. So, that's gaming. So these parasites on Wall Street are making us all pay more for the food on the table and the gas in the tank for no productive social end except to make themselves wealthy at the expense of working and middle-class Americans.
There's no doubt about that, Ian. But I just want to differ a little bit from the way you're putting it, only because if we look at the rest of the economy, the same is taking place. When productivity continues to rise and wages are stagnant, that means that corporate profits are rising, as in fact they have been. And as those corporate profits rise, so the stock market does, and therefore those who can manage to capture a portion of the corporate profits and the gains in the stock market, who are capturing, as it turns out, all of those gains, in a very tiny minority at the top, inside and outside the financial sector, then we've got a problem on our hands.
Well,
and those economic institutions, as I say, both on Wall Street and on Main Street, are failing us.
Well, let me just close on Joe Stiglitz, the Nobel laureate's speech to the AFL-CIO. He said 165 years ago, Abraham Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." We have become a house divided against itself, divided between the 99% and the 1%, between the workers and those who would exploit them. I thank you for joining us, David Ruscio.
Thank you very much, Ian. I enjoyed it.
Again, I've been speaking with David Ruscio, who is a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. His books include Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, Rethinking Planning, Development, Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis, and his forthcoming book is Mind the Gap. His occasional links and commentary are available at anticap.wordpress.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.